Revelation 17. We finished the first six verses. We finished parts of 7, 8, 9. Here and there, but I'm going to pick back up in 7. But it starts in verse 7. It says, "Then the angel said to me, 'Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mysteries of the woman and of the beast, with the seven heads and the 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up from the abyss and go into destruction. Those who live on the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast that was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind that has wisdom." And then it'll pick up after that, going into some details about the beast and about the woman. But if we go back to the first six verses, there's a couple of things that I want to touch on moving forward, because the first six verses kind of give the key to the next few verses, the next eight verses, because those are the description of those first six verses. And before we started this evening, I kind of read to you a couple of things. There's a lot of detail that does come out of Revelation 17. And we're basically, all Revelation 17 does is recall us back to earlier things in John, that John has said in Revelation. But it also takes you back to Daniel, to the beast, to Babylon, to Rome, to whatever, you know, all of the prophecies about the development of the final rule of the Antichrist, which leads you into this conversation a little bit. And there's detail that's here, and it is significant. We'll go through it, but we do want to just kind of leave it at this, that, you know, there's a clear picture of the future, but it's important to see that God has revealed, you know, God is revealed in the final patterns of history. There's certain things that are happening here that we're going to see. And, you know, by the criteria that we're looking at here and the fact that there's this leaning toward, a lot of scholars believe this leaning toward this pseudo-Christian attitude, and that Babylon is more of a religious rather than a city for the times that we're in now. So it could be first century Rome for the apostles and the disciples and the followers at the time. Now it's more that religion could be the enemy to God. And it's not necessarily belief that's important, but what is important is the one in whom we believe. And so with that, it basically leads us into this conversation that a counterfeit faith is really, no matter how much it may seem in harmony with the culture, it's an enemy to God. And that's kind of the conversation that we get out of this chapter in Revelation. Just going back a little bit, you know, it does bring up the book of life. It brings up that the book of life has existed since the foundation of the world. I mean, we could get into the details of all of that and really talk about that in some forms, and we probably will maybe a little later on when we get to it again. I mean, it's a recurring conversation, and as we've talked about a little bit before, you know, it takes us back to Exodus, where you see the story of the Israelites had a book that accounted for their citizenship, so to speak. And so because they had that book, you know, if their name wasn't in the book of citizenship, it could be blotted out. You could be born into it and then blotted out. I think it would follow the same method. The same method with God. I mean, it was God's book for the Israelites. And if they broke a creed with God, if they broke covenant, then that method, or the method was to blot them out of the book. And we even see that Moses asked to be blotted out of the book. And when Moses asked to be blotted out, God said, "No, I will blot them out for their lack of, or for their lack of obedience and their lack of faith." And so I don't see any reason why the church should think it would follow any different suit. Almost everything God has done with Israel seems to be what's happening in the book of Revelation. So when we get to that conversation, it's more of a, you know, yes, it's existed since the foundation of the earth. Well, how is your name put in or taken away? Well, Revelation 22 kind of gives us an insight into that, saying that names can be blotted out. Is our name added to the book at any given time? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what time. If the book has existed from the foundation of the earth, then there's the possibility of you being blotted out for not following or tagging along or, you know, accepting. Then rejection of Christ seems to be the way that your name can be blotted out of the book. So I would lean toward that method of conversation, that, you know, in that regard, is our name from the beginning in the book and we have the opportunity to blot it out by rejecting the call of the Spirit? I think that's a good argument. I think that there's other arguments of that your name's not in the book until the day that you accept Christ as your Lord and Savior. There's nothing that really tells us exactly how the name is entered into the book, other than that Christ owns the book because he's the Lamb slain from the beginning of the world for the sins of the world. And so that, I think, is the best way we can look at that as we continue the conversation. And then we get into the conversation about the beast that is and what, I mean, really the Antichrist here leans you to into the conversation that he has Christ-like features, that he was slain and reborn. Earlier in chapter 13, you see the same story about the Antichrist, where that he had the head that was wounded and then returned. I think it was chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 3, I believe. And then there's this evil source of power that is noted, that he rose out of the bottomless pit, which is the same story for the demons. And then the emphasis sort of shifts when we talk about the book of life here at the end. And that emphasis is that not only did God plan to redeem from the beginning, he planned who would be redeemed from the beginning. And that would be those whose name is in the book of life. That, again, doesn't necessarily translate into that the names were there. That just simply says those whose name is in the book of life would be redeemed. Those who are not redeemed. And no stronger statement of the sovereignty of God in things pertaining to salvation is found than maybe in verse 8 of chapter 17. So that being said, verse 9 then starts and says, this calls for a mind that has wisdom. In other words, not just knowledge, but wisdom. Being smart isn't going to help you. It's being wise that will help you. You know, you can have all the book knowledge in the world. And growing up, I heard the shortest, or the distance, the road to hell is 18 inches long. I think, yeah, the road to hell is 18 inches long, which is the distance from your brain to your heart. You know, you can know it here, but if it's not lived out from here, from your heart, then what purpose is there for you to, I mean, you can know it and live it in certain circles, but it's what the heart of the matter is. I mean, you hear constantly the argument that God knows the heart, God knows the heart, God knows the heart. Well, yeah, but God doesn't care about the deeds. He does see the deeds through the actions of the heart overflowing, and the deeds come with that. But if you're just doing the deeds mindlessly without the heart involved, you know, you're doing it for man's praise. You got your reward, so to speak. So then it goes into details starting there. This calls for a mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings. Now, I'm going to read through verse 11 before I go any farther in the conversation, but they are also seven kings. Now, just remember as we read through these, verses 9 through 11 contain a riddle. And honestly, scholars have argued over it, so I'm not real sure that I have right answers to anything. I really like riddles, but just bear with me here. Because it says, they are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only for a little while. The beast that was and is not is itself an eighth king. But it belongs to the seven and is going to destruction. Anybody figure it out? I did kind of give homework for the next time, but it wasn't supposed to be until next Sunday or a couple weeks from now. What you got? Joe's thinking over there. Oh, he's got a commentary he's reading. I have a discussion that probably won't end the arguments, but it's a valid topic to discuss with this, and I think it's a valid point to make, maybe a valid view, so to speak. But the seven heads or seven heels on which the woman sits, that's plain and simple. It's what it says. In the first century, this would seem to point to Rome, which was famous for the seven heels. So there is that. And that's why a lot of discussion has to do with Babylon the Great being Rome. But the woman sits on seven heels. Well, Rome's famous for that. So that is a good conversation starter. The seven heads are also seven kings. So this is where we can move the view maybe from Rome to something greater, something different. And there's been a lot of attempts to make the kings fit into some scheme of the Roman emperors, but none of them were compelling. And one of the arguments, I think, was that there were seven emperors from the time this happened to the destruction of Rome. I don't necessarily buy into that, but the eighth was of the seven, so there's eight kings, so to speak. More symbolic approach here may see seven as the number of completion. And that being that we constantly have seen seven in Revelation as a number of completion. So seven being the number of completion, five fallen kings means that we are nearing completion, especially in view of the sixth king currently reigning, which leaves only one that is to come. And that would be the Antichrist. The Antichrist is not limited to a single individual, but rather a raw military political power hostile to God. It could be a number of things. Five kingdoms belong to past history. A sixth kingdom, Rome, ruled the world. This is where this is getting a really interesting conversation going, by the way. The seventh and final kingdom will be that of the Antichrist. So if Rome was the sixth kingdom, well, has there been a kingdom since? Other than maybe England. But, I mean, that's not where the conversation goes.
Are you talking about like the kingdom that ruled over Israel, or are you talking about a kingdom overall?
Right. See, that's where the conversation happens. All right. So from the perspective of world history, we can understand why the interpreting angel skipped from Rome directly to Antichrist's dominion. While the devil has attacked Christian people viciously and more martyrs have joined their predecessors every century, there has not been a unified worldwide political military assault on Christians since the days of Rome until maybe now with ISIS and the Muslims. I hesitate to say because there's not, the world's still kind of unified against them. So I hesitate to say that that's it. Unless it's the eighth one that's part of the seven. If that makes sense. But let's continue the conversation for a moment. Because this changes with the rise of the seventh kingdom. When the seventh and final kingdom finally arrives, its leader will be an eighth king, the final personal Antichrist. And this is extremely puzzling for the monster that John had seen only seven heads. Where does the eighth head come from? And the eighth is, in a sense, that he'd be distinct from the other seven. He is of the seven, not one of the seven. In that he plays the same sort of role of his earthly predecessors. He is the Antichrist, not simply another human ruler. He's not a human ruler through whom the power of evil finds expression. He is the power himself. That's a valid view of what will happen. And looking at world history, no, there hasn't really been a unified world kingdom since Rome. There had been prior to that five others. So it's a valid view of what could be the possibility, that we're still waiting on that one world view of the way that things might go. Does that make sense? Because that takes us into the conversation, and I think I can get through a couple of verses real quickly, but the 10 horns you saw, verse 12, then continues this, but that's kind of the answer to the riddle in the way I can look at it and look over some of this stuff, but it's really difficult to say that that's the right view. That's just a view. Because there's so many different ways that it could be viewed, looking at some of the world history that exists. But verse 12 says, the 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they will receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. And then these have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will conquer them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Those with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Verses 12 and 13, you see that 10 horns are said to be 10 kings that have not yet received their royal power. When they do receive authority, their sole purpose of authority is to turn it over to the One. So when the Antichrist takes power, 10 kings will be named to 10 kingdoms. Those 10 kings will pledge allegiance to the Antichrist. That's, I don't know that there's any other way to put it than what is put right here. Well, the number 10 is symbolic and indicates completeness. It indicates, even more so maybe than the 7, but it indicates a completeness. And it does not point to 10 specific kings, 10 European kingdoms of a revived Roman Empire. Ultimately, the 10 kings represents the totality of the powers of all nations on the earth, which are to be subservient to the Antichrist. And then in verse 14, which has a lot to it, so I'm not really going to dive into it yet. But in verse 14, it focuses attention not on the entire period of the monster's reign, but on the end. I'm going to leave it at that, and we'll pick back up at verse 14 the next time. But it leads you to believe, you know, and it honestly provides additional detail to the verse back in 16:14, where it says, for they are demonic spirits performing signs who travel to the kings of the whole world to assemble for the battle on the great day of God, the Almighty. And so it takes us back to that verse, which the beast gathered the kingdoms of the world for battle against God. So that's where we're going to pick back up with 17:14. It's interesting how it all goes together, and we're seeing two different visions, or this being, you know, maybe the last of the visions, but certainly there's a lot that ties together. I mean, I've got 16, 17 points just on verse 14 that I have yet to dive into and have no time to do so with tonight, unless you guys say, yeah, let's finish verse 14. Because it's kind of like the to be continued of a movie at this point. Because it's like there's a cliffhanger and you want to know the end. But really, the end is there. You see the means to the end. And then verses 15, 16, 17, 18, I'm going to read them, but I'm going to leave it alone. But it says, he also said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute was seated are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The 10 horns you saw in the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked, devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their heart to carry out his plan by having one purpose, to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman you saw is the great city that has royal power over the kings of the earth. In other words, these 10 kings are going to serve and give it over. We're going to go into more detail next time, but does that clear some things up maybe?